But I guess it's
where you been?
Set up first.
I can call this meeting of the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness to order for Thursday, May 21st. Make a couple of comments. First, we're going to do the public hearings, but for those that are interested in Senate Bill 87, we're not going to move the bill today, but we will have conversations about how we're going to eventually move the bill. So, but that will be after we've held these public hearings. And so the first public hearing I'm going to open is Senate Bill 93. For the purposes to allow Senator Montes Anderson to provide testimony. Mr. Administrator, do you want to just introduce the bill for us, please?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senate Bill 93 requires insurance to provide reimbursement for up to a 90-day supply of previously dispensed eligible prescription drugs in certain circumstances as specified.
Okay. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson representing Gresham, Troutdale, Delwood Village, Fairview, and a little bit of East Portland, and I think your committee administrator stated it pretty well. Senate Bill 93 requires health plans to provide reimbursement of a prescription drug for up to a 90-day supply. And I will let the committee talk more in depth. This was highly negotiated on the Senate side. And there's more work that will need to be done, but my recommendation, although you are, it's certainly up to you to decide, would be to let's work on it in the interim to work on it a little bit more to expand or make it a better bill. And that's really all I have to say.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions for the senator?
Oh, not a question, but a comment. Thank you, Senator Montes Anderson, for all your good work on this and helping us get to this point. This, colleagues, this is part of the resilience plan recommendation list, and we we concur that we need to do a little bit more to bring everybody to the same side of the table. So, I think that's what we intend to do. And I think we have agreement around, but we'll have a work group in the interim work on this and hope that we get to it, remembering that our purpose in all this is to keep our citizens safe and not falling into the kind of situation where they would run out of their meds and have a disaster and not be able to get the medications they need, thereby causing them a much harsher recovery.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. So I'm going to, at this point, close, and then I'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 93, but I'm going to open a public hearing on SCR 7. Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, SCR 7 memorialized Specialist John Alexander Pelham. Specialist Pelham succumbed to wounds received from enemy fire on February 12, 2014, in Kapisa Province, Afghanistan. He proudly served as a signal intelligence analyst assigned to Headquarters Company, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Special Forces Group, Fort Bragg, North Carolina. His awards and decorations include the Bronze Star Medal, Purple Heart Medal, Meritorious Service Medal, Joint Achievement Medal, Army Commendation Medal, Army Good Conduct Medal, National Defense Service Medal, the Afghanistan Campaign Medal with Campaign Device, the Global War on Terrorism Service Medal, the Army Service Ribbon, the Overseas Service Ribbon, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization Medal, Combat Action Badge, and the Parachutist Badge. Senate Confer Resolution 7 honors him.
Very good. So we have Representative Helm and Mr. Pelham here. Thank you very much for attending.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Ken Helm, State Representative from House District 34, and I'm joined today by Wendell Pelham, John's father. My opening statements were going to list the very same list of awards and accolades that John received during his military career, and so I won't repeat that. They're well-deserved, and from what I've been able to learn about John's service and lifetime, he was a very well-liked member and a good sibling. A good brother in arms, a good citizen, and a great role model. He's survived by his mother, Dawn, and his father, Wendell, and his siblings, and I'll let Wendell explain more about the family if he so desires. I have a couple prepared remarks that I wanted to let you know about. John was killed February 12, 2004, while serving in Lapisia province in Afghanistan. And he was part of the 2nd Battalion, 3rd Special Forces Group in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. And he was serving his second tour in Afghanistan. I wanted to say just a couple of things about this continuing resolution and its importance. I know that as a committee you hear similar information quite often. This is my first time as a legislator introducing the family members of a fallen soldier. And I've listened with great interest to the multiple times that we've acknowledged fallen military service members on the floor, and I've come to see it as one of the most important things that our body does. To personalize this a little bit, I think some of you may know that I have a 14-year-old son, Jackson, who's a great kid. Jackson's namesake was one Marion Jackson Brewster, who was a third grandfather to me. And Jack Brewster survived Pearl Harbor and went on to serve for the rest of World War II in the Navy. And he later became a helicopter specialist after the war. Came back, raised a fabulous family, and lived a good life. I met him when he was already a grandfather to his own kids. And he made a big impression on my life, and I was thrilled to be able to name my son after him. And through that, I've been able to recall Jack Brewster most days of my life. And it's been a great blessing to me to be able to do that. And in thinking about what we're doing for the Pelham family today, I think we're doing something similar in that we're adding another piece to the story of John's life, which goes on. And his dad will tell you a little bit more about that. And the small things that we do, such as identifying the service through a continuing resolution and enabling the state and the county to erect a sign along Walker Road, which is in the district that will recognize John Pelham's life. They're small things that we're doing, and they don't measure up to the men or women that we are memorializing, but they are small additions to their life story, and through that accumulation, very important. So I'm very proud and honored to be a part of this today, and I'll let Wendell tell you a little bit more about his son.
Thank you very much. I'm Wendell Pelham. I live in Beaverton, Oregon, or Portland, Oregon. My son, John Alexander Pelham, was 22 years old when he was killed. He was killed in February 12th of last year. I spoke to John just a few days before he was killed, and recognized at the time that as a father, I could hear his voice, that this was probably the last time I'd ever speak to him again. And then on the 12th of February, while being at work, I get a phone call from my wife asking why two gentlemen in dressed blues were standing on our front porch. And I grew up in the military. My father was a retired full colonel. My older brother, so John's uncle, was an E-8 sergeant in the Ranger Battalion. So the Pelhams consider the military a family business. When I finally got my head out of a position that shouldn't have been in and decided to join the military, I'd already had 5 knee surgeries, 3 hernias, and a thumb reconstruction, and they laughed and said, "You're more than welcome to go run the PX or the officers' club," and I decided to do other things in life. John has always had a phenomenal desire to represent the underdog. And when he decided to enlist, he wanted to do just that. And the motto for the Special Forces, Deo Preste Libre, in a loose interpretation, is to defend the oppressed and to free the oppressed. And that's what John did. That's who he was. So a fallen hero's sign is a small yet extremely significant honor that we can pay our service members and our veterans that go into harm's way. And, you know, in an entirely volunteer service, they write that proverbial check that may be cashed up to and including their lives. And that's what my son did. We are, to say the least, beyond proud of who our son is and what he accomplished in his short 22 years. As Representative Helm stated, this was my son's second deployment. And I can't think of anything else that my son would rather do than to be with his battle buddies, to be with his team, defending the freedoms that we all enjoy. So we affectionately refer to John as the gift that just keeps giving. He's been gone for a little over a year. And very rarely does a day not go by that someone recognizes him for what he did. Today I got a Facebook post from Afghanistan, from the same gym that he worked out in every day. And it was one of his buddies saying, over the next few days during the Memorial Day weekend, we want you all that are in the gym to post your funniest gym pose in honor of John Pelham, because he was a gym rat as well. On Sunday, our family is honored to fly to Baltimore, Maryland, and we will be guests of the National Security Agency on Tuesday. And on Tuesday, they will unveil my son's name on their Wall of Heroes. So every day, I get to go work out. Every day, I will get to drive right by this sign, because it's going to be on the corner of Roxbury Avenue and Walker Road. And all of the people that knew John, that live in our district, that live in our area, his high school friends, will all be able to see it and pay honor to it. And so please do whatever is necessary to see that this gets moved through. And that in a very short period of time, I would love to invite all of you to come to the gathering prior to the sign erection and have you see the sign and then come back and see it in its place. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And thank you very much. We're sorry for your loss, but we sincerely appreciate your coming and sharing the story with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Any comments or questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Helm, for bringing this. Anybody else who wishes to offer testimony on SCR 7? Not, I'll close the public hearing. So now I'm going to... I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 93. Let's see, you already provided the overview of what the bill is, didn't you?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, we also have two proposed amendments, and then there's been multiple submissions on a list for testimony today.
Okay. So I have several people have signed up to testify. So Jeff Rubin, Robert, I think it's Judge, and Elise Brown. Just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Boone and Escobel, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Rubin. I'm the emergency manager for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I'm also the vice chair of the Oregon Resilience Task Force, also known as the Governor's Task Force on Resilience Plan Implementation. I've been involved in institutional and individual and healthcare preparedness for over 20 years at pretty much every level of government, public and private sector. There are a few things that we know really well when it comes to disasters and even lower scale emergencies. in every disaster, every extended power outage, really any other significant disruption to people's ability to get around or do their basic activities. People tend to lose access to most or all of their healthcare resources, including the ability to refill their prescription medications. So what this does, and we see it again and again, is it takes a relatively stable chronic patient and turns them into an unstable acute patient at the worst possible time. The effects of this may be temporary, or they may last for weeks, as once you get out of that stable phase, it can take a long time to rebalance, and some never recover. And it doesn't take a catastrophe for this to happen. The December 8th, 2008 snowstorm, which was the last presidentially declared disaster for the metro region, and it was a snowstorm, just within our agency's service area, we saw multiple people who either due to bad fortune or lack of planning or lack of access, or had either run out of prescription meds, lost access to simple consumables like home oxygen bottles, things like that. So it doesn't take a catastrophe for this to happen. Anytime we have a disaster with warning across the U.S., and obviously we don't get that luxury with earthquakes, CDC will typically send out an alert for this type of occurrence. You know, healthcare providers, be aware you are going to encounter this amongst your patients, whether they are primary care or emergency. And there's substantial documentation, substantial peer-reviewed research. Probably one of the best is a 2010 study from UCLA Schools of Public Health and Medicine and LA County Public Health, which identified access to refills of maintenance prescriptions as a critical preparedness step. The quote was, flexible drug dispensing policies help patients build reserves, being one of their top recommendations. TVFNR, in my home agency, we certainly have been pitching that in our preparedness page for quite a while. I pitched that in my presentations to the public. And it's been part of various national resilience processes, whether by the Institutes of Medicine, National Research Council, or more recently the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I would put building a reserve of prescription medications well ahead of buying a prefab preparedness kit. The key is, once someone is able to establish a reserve, then it's simply a matter of periodically rotating medications, simply like as they would do with food, water, other consumables, to keep them current unless they're actually used. It's not a guarantee. It is enabling. People still have to make some effort, but we rarely get a chance to make a meaningful impact on individual and community resilience in such a direct manner as legislation like this would allow. You know, for a lot of our proposed outcome, proposed resilience measures from the task force and the Oregon Resilience Plan, it may take years, it may take decades to assess how effective they were, to see what kind of outcomes we get. Whereas something like this, enabling, you know, even a single additional refill per year, we know would have a significant outcome, whether it's a major disaster or what a lot of people would consider to be an inconvenience, like a big snowstorm. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Please, sir.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Judge. I'm the Director of Pharmacy Services for Moda Health. Moda Health is a Northwest-based insurance provider providing dental, medical, and pharmacy and insurance and administrative services to members throughout the Northwest. We have roughly 500,000 members in Oregon who get their prescription drug coverage through Moda Health. I'm appearing today before this committee to speak in favor of passage of Senate Bill 93 without amendment. Senate Bill 93 allows retail pharmacies to dispense up to a 90-day supply of generic medications to individuals who wish to have retail pharmacies fill these medications for them. At the same time, and as was referenced earlier by Senator Moniz Anderson, Senate Bill 93 has many safeguards in it that preserve the payers of prescription drugs and the requirements that we have in there relative to how we manage patients' safety, how we ensure the integrity of the pharmacy benefits that we administer, and how we ensure that the cost of prescription medications can be controlled. So there's several provisions in this Senate Bill 93 that we believe are vital to its passage, and these include: Number one, ensuring that patient safety is maintained. It excludes Schedule II drugs, which are substances that have a high potential for abuse and have severe psychological and physical dependence issues related to them. Those drugs are excluded from this bill. It excludes specialty medications, which are really high-cost medications that require special handling and administration to ensure that patients are taking these medications and they're not having any adverse reactions to those medications. The 30-day cycle of delivering those drugs ensures the connectivity between the pharmacist and the patient to ensure proper outcomes. So those are excluded from this provision. Ensuring those elements in this legislation, I think, are vital to ensure patient safety in the course of treatments that they receive. Second, Senate Bill 93A, conforms with payers' benefit designs and our reimbursement terms. It limits the abilities of pharmacies to dispense 90-day supplies of medications to our payers' existing pharmacy benefit designs and formulary placements and the reimbursement terms that we assign to those. So it doesn't create a shift to kind of the payer infrastructure of how drug benefits are managed and delivered. That helps ensure effective controls on drug formulary placements, ensuring the right therapeutic outcomes at the right cost. What that really means is that we're excluding generic drugs, or we're limiting this to generic drugs, and avoiding high-cost branded products from being included in there because of the course of treatments that those receive and the utilization management controls that that payers require on those drugs to ensure effective management and controls for those drugs. And so by doing, we're controlling kind of prescription drug spend, which is all ever-present in everybody's minds today anytime they go to the pharmacy to get drugs paid. So each of these provisions are critical to the success of Senate Bill 93. It's for these reasons that MOTA is supporting this bill in its current form and urge its passage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Boone.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions. Thank you, Jeff, first, for your service to the committee, and I hope you'll be able to continue in the next one to get that through. There's a couple of things that I'd like to ask, and I can't remember your name.
Sorry. Barbara Judge.
Okay, Mr. Judge. And I still have a problem with the generic only, mm-hmm. because right now you can get 90 days of name brand drugs through the mail. Mm-hmm. And so let's just give you a scenario of in our rural areas, we have small pharmacies, and sometimes that's it, or they don't have the luxury of having a Costco or Safeway or Fred Meyer. Mm-hmm. And they can only get drugs at their drugstore, and they want to support their small businesses. And this, if they're on a prescription that has a name only, name brand only, they're going to be forced to get it by mail because, you know, what you're not supporting is the same service, only walk-in. Mm. And so I'm kind of confused about that. I did have a meeting with four different insurance companies, and they assured me it was really because of drug pricing, and that's a whole other ball of wax. And but the thing that I just keep coming back to is it kind of sounds like the insurance companies are practicing medicine because a doctor has prescribed this prescription, yet the insurance company is saying, sorry, if you want to walk in and pick it up, you're limited to 30 days. Well, what if on day 29 the big one hits? And I have been assured that the specialty meds and everybody else is going to, you know, your people are going to get drugs to them, but I said, how? And they said, well, we're going to drive them over to the coast. I said, no, no bridges, no roads, no way to get through by car. Somebody made a suggestion to me just a minute ago that you would have to have drones to deliver them, and you'd have to know who needed them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Mr. Rubin very succinctly stated how this, why this bill is being put into place, or hopefully. And that is because when people run out of their meds, you chance having a much worse condition and situation that your insurance company is going to have to pay quite a bit more for. So I'm just wondering if you can address some of my concerns.
Thank you for the question, Representative Boone, Chairman, members of the committee. There are a couple of elements that you raised there. Let's talk about brand products being dispensed for at retail for day supply greater than 30 days. You're right. There is a cost differential, a pretty significant cost differential, by being able to aggregate volume and have that delivered through consolidated carriers, the mail order pharmacies. And that helps keep costs down. Brand drugs are back up. 87% of all drugs that are dispensed in the market today are generic. So the vast majority of drugs are generics, which this bill addresses. The 13% that are brand are many times more expensive than a generic drug. And by having them dispensed in a retail environment under a retail reimbursement scheme could add 10% to a patient's cost or more. They're paying percent, tend to pay a percent of a drug cost and pharmacy benefits today. So it's by adding the ability to get a 90-day supply in a retail environment, you're really adding cost to both patients and payers when there's more cost-effective ways to distribute the same drug to a patient. Now, the second part of your question dealt with situations where there's a disaster or the inability for patients to get their drugs. Let's use the example of a tsunami on the coast. Depending on perspectives, a tsunami is going to wipe out a city's infrastructure, meaning retail pharmacies are wiped out. Having the mail order be able to deliver those drugs in, if roads are available, is an option. Disaster preparedness would say that you have the ability to get drugs from the state's warehouse disaster capabilities. There are certain warehouse drugs that can be made available to communities under a kind of a disaster situation where there's no payment involved with billing the drug to a payer. So I think there's provisions in place to account for disaster. Having a bill accommodate a greater than 30-day supply for brand in the event of that situation when there's infrastructure in place that could address it adequately, I think is something that MOTAs and probably peer insurers would question the logic behind. So it's those reasons that I would respond to that question.
Okay, can I just do a follow-up?
Sure.
So could you maybe indulge me a little bit here? Give me a comparison of choose a drug that would be 90 days by mail, and then how much would it be 30 days at the pharmacy, just for the comparison?
Yes, Representative, thank you for the question. Chairman, members of the committee, a typical differential between a drug dispensed in a retail, and there's no uniformity in prices, how insurers or how drugs are paid for, but it could be as up to 10% differential between what a drug for dispensed in a retail environment would be paid for versus, and that's for a 30-day supply. You know, if a 30-day supply was dispensed in a retail environment and used the same contracted terms that would be available in a mail order environment for the same supply, be roughly 10% differential. So you do that times three, the dollars could be pretty substantial. If the average brand is selling for $500, that's that's for a 90-day supply. It's a $150 delta, pretty substantial. When you've got drug trends, which are really the year-over-year cost increases of pharmaceuticals increasing, anywhere between 7.5% and 10%, that multiplier effect is substantial. And all payers, whether it's insurers or self-insured organizations like OEB here or PEB, keeping drug costs down it's critical. But giving options to patients is something that they want to preserve.
Right. Follow up. I guess I just don't understand why it's different, because I get meds by mail, and I pay three copays mm-hmm. for 3 months. And if I have to go into pharmacy in exactly this kind of situation, only it's really not, it's because I'm here and not at home, and I have them call it into Fred Meyer down here, but I'm allowed to buy 3 days' worth of meds, you know, at pretty much full cost. I'm pretty sure it's way over my copay. So I think the point of this is to have, like, say I forget my meds at home and it's 3 hours away, and or say that I'm in Europe and that has happened to me. I can go in Stockholm, I can buy everything I take over the counter, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure I'm getting, you know, because they're
sure.
called something different, you know. Yeah. But anyway, my point is I don't understand, and maybe this is a question for the pharma people, but it just seems to me that a company like Moda and the big insurance companies would want to, sorry?
Nothing.
Oh, sorry. would want to, you know, in light of being full service and all that, accommodate people, especially people on the, you know, in the rural areas who really don't, who want to support their family pharmacies or whatever. So I'm just, you know, and that, I guess I'll just say that, because we could talk for a long time on mm-hmm. this. But that's the part that bothers me, and the just limiting it to generics, especially says, writes a letter and all that, says, no, I want this patient to have this name drug, would you still limit that then?
The simple answer is, for any individual, there are manifold opportunities to have an authorization override. Every health plan has that facility to have the provider submit an authorization for an override.
Okay. Well, I guess it's the final now. I'm trying not to rant here, but as much as I'm disappointed that we're at this point, I want to get some bill rather than no bill. And I hope that you'll be willing to join the other insurance companies who have assured me that they will join in a work group in the interim and work toward a consensus of something that brings us a little closer to what we really need and what our purpose.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely.
Because I know I'm taking on Goliath here. You know what I'm saying?
I'm just 5'7". Yes, I understand your point.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just struggling with what you're saying, and I'm applying it to myself. If I go into a pharmacy and I buy a name drug once a month, I go in there three times in 90 days. The pharmacist works three times in 90 days. The paperwork and the insurance companies works three times in 90 days. And yet I could do it in one time, and you're telling me it's going to cost me more. I don't understand that.
Representative Esquivel, chairman and members of the committee, it's mostly math.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So, let me kind of take you
through.
Trust me,
kind I'm fairly decent at math.
Yeah. So, every insurance carrier that covers a pharmacy benefit puts in place networks of pharmacies, and they contract with those pharmacies at different rates. And retail pharmacies participate in a class of trade that is defined that has a reimbursement level associated with the day supply that they dispense for. Likewise, providers, whether it's insurer or the PBM, negotiate with mail order pharmacies to contract for services for them to dispense via mail. Mail order organizations are different economic animals. They're consolidators, really, of volume. So because they have more volume, they can offer more heavily discounted products. And that makes good sense for consumers, and it makes good sense for payers of prescription drugs, whether it's the insurer or the self-insured employer group, to say, I can buy that drug from even if you say 90-day supply equals supplies, I can buy it more cheaply here than here. So the economic model for carriers to manage pharmacy benefits in a way that is cost-effective for those who pay for those drugs, whether it's the individual or the employer, is to try to use a strategy that allows maximum access to drugs through an through a provider network, a pharmacy network, but also give individuals an opportunity to get increased volumes through contracted providers that they have with mail order pharmacies.
Follow up. I understand that. I understand the part. But what if I don't participate in a mail order? I'm still going to the same store, paying the same price three times in a 90-day period versus one time in a 90-day period. Now, tell me why that's economically advantageous to me.
Under the existing...
Because I have to go back and forth three times as well.
Under the existing Senate bill, the provision to allow for a 90-day supply of generic medications, which again is 87% of all drugs that are dispensed. So the vast majority of
Let's move generic off the table. Let's talk about a name brand. That's what I'm trying to get at. Mm-hmm. Why is that so different if I have to go there three times, if I have to pick it up three times, if I have to drive back and forth three times, the pharmacist has to lay it out three times, they have to do the paperwork three times, the insurance people have to do it three times, but I'm still getting the same results. Why is that different?
Nobody mandates in MOTA's environment, because I can't speak to other carriers. A mail order mandate is not required. Consumers can choose to get where their drugs are and get them filled where they want to. It's a consumer's choice as to whether they want to take advantage of a price advantage through mail order or whether they want to make three visits to the pharmacy over 90 days. Nobody's mandating that. But the option exists for consolidated volumes to offer deeper price discounts. If retailers came to the table and said, I will take that deep discount like they do with Part D, then it's a different economic equation. But that's not what we've been discussing.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. You can try one more time.
I'm going to try one more time here.
Thank you.
I exclude your mail order. I chose not to do that. What is the advantage of me as a consumer of not being able to buy that on a 90-day period versus once a month? For again, I repeat, I have to go in three times. I have to pay the same price three times over. Then the pharmacist has to do the same thing three times. They have to do the insurance part on the pharmaceutical side as well as the insurance side three times. But I'm still paying the same thing. Why is that such a problem? I have the choice to go mail order if I so desire.
If a retail pharmacy would be willing to contract at higher volume rates, that's a different discussion. But
wouldn't that be between the insurance company and the pharmacy?
Yeah, insurers or pharmacy benefit managers, they reimburse pharmacies for the drugs that they dispense at a negotiated price. It's not a cost-plus world. It's a bizarro world of how pharmaceuticals are priced, primarily driven by how pharma prices products in the marketplace.
Follow up. But haven't we already done that? Because I'm buying the name brand there anyway.
At a 30-day reimbursement rate, which is more expensive.
But isn't that something that's between you as the insurer and the pharmacy, not me, the end user? Because I'm making the choice whether I want to go mail order or I want to go into my pharmacy.
And in the provisions that we're talking about, I apologize for this didactic back and forth.
No, that's fine. Go ahead. Thank you.
In the provisions that we're talking about is what we've fought hard for is to ensure that the formularies, which are really the drugs that are allowed to be dispensed, aren't impacted. The benefit designs around how charges are made for those and what percent the patient pays versus what part a payer pays, whether it's an employer or an insurer. As long as the economics around that are maintained, we have a basis for discussion. But there, and we had to fight really hard to get that embedded into the existing legislation. As long as that's preserved, I think we have a basis, as Representative Boone was discussing, for conversations. But when you start taking away the payer's ability to manage formularies, to manage benefit designs, so that the economics make sense to the payers, whether it's consumer or the insurer or the employer, then the whole thing, the economics start unwrapping, and that's what we're worried about.
I might just say, colleague, I serve on the healthcare committee, where normally these kind of things, and I still don't get it all. I appreciate your questions and frustration when trying to understand it, but I've been on the healthcare committee for 3 years now, and it's very complex, and I appreciate your patience for trying to go through with us here on the Veterans Committee to explain something. Doesn't mean we'll like the answer, but I appreciate you trying to provide the answer. Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that was part of what I was going to do, was apologize for all of you guys having to come before for a Veterans Committee, which is probably fairly ill-equipped with the exception of one individual that actually serves on a health care committee and deals a little more with health care and pharma than a Veterans Committee does. So I wanted to apologize for that, and I wanted to thank everybody for the work that's been done on this bill. And my comments are going to come out of a Veterans Committee perspective, of a personal kind of deep-seated perspectives that I've always had, and it's not going to change anything on this bill or anything in this room, and there's probably not going to be a question in here at all. But I do appreciate everybody's work, and I do believe I understand that the bill actually does something. It moves the ball down the road. 90 days on generic is more than is allowed now. And so that's a good thing, and I appreciate that. I don't understand why under the contract that, you know, pharma has with insurers and they then with their clients, I don't understand if it can be done through the mail, why it can't be done under contract for those same drugs if I walk into hometown pharmacy. So I am challenged by that. But philosophically, I have a challenge with anything other than basic drugs going through the mail. And I know we're not going to change that here today. I've had family members that I've stepped in and actually helped save their life by getting a consultant come in because they were getting drugs through the mail, and they should have been doing a face-to-face with the pharmacist, who is the last line of defense and the gatekeeper in the healthcare continuum, and checking for drug interactions and stuff if you're getting that through the mail. I question the person on the mailing end, mm-hmm. how much they're going to really be tuned into that person's health care. That perspective also comes from the fact I grew up in a small town and I knew my hometown pharmacist and had the relationship, and he said, John, are you sure you really want to take both these drugs mm-hmm. at the same time? The final perspective is that since I represent a lot of rural and frontier Oregon, you know, I really am protective and have been frustrated over the years with OEB and other contracts that have been developed that pool our teachers and other state and government employees in rural and frontier areas, where they pretty much have to get their pharmas through the mail, and it really puts a financial challenge on John and Ann Murray, for example, at Murray's Pharmacy and Hepner Condon, you know, John Day. It's challenging for them. So I'm always trying to look out for their best interests, because if Frontier Oregon and where the far out places lose the John and Ann's that have been willing to go out and set up shop in rural areas. And I think government, whether it's OWEB contracts or whatever, have really not thought that through clearly about how that affects. It's different in Eugene, Salem, Portland, when you have a Walgreens or a Freddy's on each corner, it's different out where we live.
Right.
Anyway, thank you for listening.
Representative Evans.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lively. And I, too, am going to have a couple of questions and some comments, but the good news is you'll know where I'm at the end.
Sure.
But first, I want to thank the speech folks that are actually sitting in the audience today. We have speech folks from high schools all across the state watching the legislature. And class, if you've never seen an amalgamation of lobbyists in one place before, this is it. So look around. Some of the best lobbyists in the building are here today. My question really is two questions followed by the comment. Question number one, naive question, but here we go. I'm assuming, and this is where you could say yes or no, that if there is an amendment to make this more than generics, then it becomes significantly more difficult to move the bill forward. Would that be a fair understanding?
There would be a lot of conversations that would have to be had about that, yes.
You're right. So I thought. Second of all, second question, 87% of the drugs out there. Now, when you say 87%, does that mean 87% of the drugs that are prescribed or 80% of the usage?
87% of what's dispensed. Yes, used.
Okay. So, thank you for that. We're not healthcare. In fact, I told the Speaker of the House that I would pay cold hard cash never to be on the healthcare committee for just that reason. But you are in front of the Veterans Emergency Preparedness Committee.
Yes.
So we're learning something, and I want to hopefully help you learn something too. For purposes of resiliency, we're the folks that actually go to bed every night thinking not what's going to happen and how bad it could be, but what we would do to try to get the state started again. Mm. We care about effectiveness far more than efficiency. And I understand the profit models on the profit side for your fiduciary responsibilities are based on efficiencies. So we're always going to have some of that push-pull, and that's just the nature of the game. I think we're all pretty similar on that. The thing to me is this. I think the optics of this particular situation look bad for the non-generics. At the end of the day, I think the bill is going to move forward. I think moving the ball forward for 87% of drugs is a pretty good day. That said, over the interim, I think it's better for everybody if we find a way, and perhaps through some creative strategies, to ensure that at some point down the future, at least 1 or 2 or 3 months, especially in frontier areas or areas we can now look and see if there is a tsunami or if there is a major strike, we at least have caches or some type of way of putting those drugs out to people. Because at the end of the day, you can sometimes get a bill passed and protect interests but still lose the day. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody in this room doesn't want folks to get the drugs they need when they need it. But we've got 2 or 3 different languages in clash here. Mm-hmm. And I think this bill is a good first step. And I look forward to hopefully helping play a part in getting us where we need to go long term, even if that means a little bit of give or take in terms of our primary responsibilities, ours being effectiveness, yours being efficiency. So thank you for coming today and bringing this forward. And I hope we can see this looking back as the first step of moving forward toward not just drugs, but a number of pre-deployed assets. So as Mr. Rubin would say, getting us ready for when that next event happens. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your willingness to dialogue with us. That's very helpful.
Thank you very much.
Sure. So I'm going to call up Bill Cross, Dave Stuckey, and Rocky Dallum.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. We have been working on Senate Bill 993 for, both when it was in the Senate, would like to continue working on the bill, and would like to see the bill, in fact, address the brand names, because we're talking about the addition of about 2,000 drugs that would be available for reimbursement under the amended version that would be reflected in the Dash 13s. And by taking care of both generics and brand names, you would have a bill that would basically provide the kind of patient access, patient safety, and it would be cost effective. The bill talks about simply giving the patient the choice of getting a 90-day supply through their plan, a mail order, or through a pharmacist. Doesn't require any difference. In fact, the language is pretty clear, although the amendment tries to even further clarify that we're talking about for the same reimbursement rate. Has nothing to do with what they might pay for 30 days. It just simply says the same reimbursement rate would have to be paid to the pharmacist if the pharmacist agreed to provide that patient who asked them to provide a 90-day supply, because they perhaps visit their pharmacist on a regular basis because of other medications and issues. So this would, that is all it would do. And to clarify something that was said earlier, pharmacies pay, brand name drugs cost the same. All pharmacies pay the same, their costs are all the same. Now, some may get rebates, so a very large payer or buyer may get some rebates, but the cost for those brand names is the same for all pharmacies. And if indeed a pharmacist wanted to take a lower reimbursement for a 90-day supply, this would allow them to do that. That would be their choice, and it would be their patient's choice. And I know some have argued that, well, my gosh, specialty drugs, 90-day supply of specialty drugs. Well, clearly, there again, the statute addresses the formularies that these plans have. And I didn't get a chance to name it, but on the website, there is a link that I put up there, and it has Providence's health plan, just as an example, their formulary. And you know what? I don't think we'll find a formulary in the state of Oregon by any insurer that's going to do a 90-day supply of a specialty drug that costs, you know, $10,000 a month. They don't authorize it now under their formularies. This bill doesn't require them to. All it says is, you know what, if you're doing a 14-day supply of a specialty drug, which is common, 14 days, maybe a month, but they're usually no longer than that because, one, the expense, and two, the storage, et cetera. Well, there again, it would be the patient's choice. And if the pharmacist wanted to accept that same reimbursement, they could do it. Now, not all pharmacies would be approved for all specialty drugs, because some manufacturers have special storage requirements. They have the dispensing of those drugs coming through specialty pharmacies. We have those now, and they're throughout the country, where they can provide the special coverage, special handling, storage, etc. But there again, for some specialty drug that may be available and the patient would choose to use that pharmacist, that's all it would do, is say you could get the same reimbursement. Doesn't add anything to the cost. Anyway, would love to see this Dash 13 at some point, the concept, move forward, because I think it would help a lot of Oregonians. Thank you for your time.
Bill, I assume that works for you, Representative Esquivel, that what he was talking about?
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to get at. Couldn't get there.
Okay, thank you. Next, whoever wants to go ahead. Sure.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, Rocky Dahlem here on behalf of the Oregon Bioscience Association, and would say that Oregon Bio doesn't find itself in this committee very often, as you probably have recognized. So Oregon Bio supports Oregon Bioscience's community through networking, educational programs, enterprise support advocacy, and the enhancement of research collaboration. Our bioscience industry here in Oregon is the fifth largest sector in the state. We employ over 17,000 Oregonians. And Oregon Bio is dedicated to the safe, effective, and ethical use of the products and devices that our members develop. Just so you know, Americans fill around 3.8 billion retail prescriptions, about 12 per person in the U.S. So obviously this is a critical issue, as the committee's recognized. We believe that expanding the reimbursement limit for prescription drugs to 90-day supply will improve patient adherence. We think that adherence to the medications that are prescribed is within that mission of the ethical use and the effective use of drugs. The cost savings from these medications can only benefit patients when they're taken as prescribed. That's another reason why adherence is so important. More frequent trips to renew prescriptions is actually not a good thing, as I think has been pointed out. So less trips, more adherence is what Oregon Bio supports to help Oregonians manage their health care. As the collective voice for the bioscience community and on behalf of Oregon's bioscience companies, we're responsible to communicating the industry's impact issues, challenges, and educate the general public, and we think that Senate Bill 93 and the 90-day supply is an effective way to meet that mission. And we would ask the committee to consider expanding the program so it would cover more than just generics, but all prescription drugs. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, former Director of the Office of Emergency Management. I've been in front of this committee a few times. I'm sure you can guess what I'm about ready to say, but I'm certainly in support of this important piece of legislation. This fits squarely in the bucket of preparedness, the very name of this committee. We've talked a lot during this session in regards to mitigation resiliency as well as response, and now we're right in a fantastic preparedness discussion. We've had a lot of movement in regards to preparedness here in the last couple of months. The national model for FEMA is 72 hours. Red Cross has gone 72 hours. OEM has endorsed and has taken on the recommendation of the OSPAC report, the resiliency report, and talked about and is moving forward to 2 weeks. And that's 2 weeks in just initial life-saving water, food type of actions. We believe that a 90-day prescription helps provide a greater level of preparedness for the citizens of this state. The closest I want to get to mathematics or cost in this discussion in my testimony is the fact that we want to avoid the cost or the impact to the citizens of this state when a cascade or a huge economic or correction, natural hazard type emergency occurs. And the more that the first responders can provide assistance to those in need, and we can mitigate or reduce the amount of effects on our citizens, the better off we're going to be. And so I certainly endorse this, appreciate the conversation. I understand that this is a very complicated process. I'm certainly happy to see the healthcare, pharmacy, and insurance industry as a part of this discussion and solution. And the Office of Emergency Management, the Oregon Military Department, looks forward to seeing this legislation move also. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for either one of these witnesses?
Thank
you very much. Elise, did you want to provide testimony? You're on my list, so. This list.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, Elise Brown for AHIP. AHIP is the National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans. Sorry, I'm speaking too loudly. And number one, apologies. I was down the hall in Senate Education speaking on an oral health bill as it relates to public schools. I just saw Representative Parrish down there. So I'm sorry. I feel whatever was said, I wasn't privy to. I will tell you that I was planning to join my AHIP member from MOTA, Robert, and I know luckily he was here to answer a lot of the technical questions, so hopefully those are all off of your list for me right now. But my statement really was on behalf of AHIP members, PBM representatives, and others who worked at great length over in the Senate chamber on the bill. And it was over a period of 3 weeks where we got up to double digits on the amendments. And at the end of the day, we came together in agreement. Some folks were neutral, some were okay. But my message to all of you is we did work very hard on the bill, and our request would be for you to pass it unamended today. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hopefully you don't have any tricky questions for me now that
it's in a boon.
Oops. So,
no, thank you, Elise. And Mr. Judge did a great job. And we really did get kind of into the weeds a little bit. So that was a good, it was a very good discussion to have. And it really cemented my will to hold an interim work group of some sort. And I know you've expressed to me before mm-hmm. you'd like to be involved, and I would hope that you would. And I hope that, I don't know how we want to do it, but it's, you know, it could be sort of a quasi-official thing. We don't have legislation making us do it, but I'm dedicated to doing that because there still are some issues out there, and I think maybe we can, you know, what Mr. Stuckey said, you know, some of his issues could be addressed. So I think it's just a matter of timing and more information. So,
Chair Lively, Representative Boone, I've had that conversation with you and with Chair Lively, speaking on behalf of all of AHIP Oregon members. I'm pledging to you as the representative that members and I will join you at the table to talk about, you know, globally how we handle these issues when we are faced with the big one, a disaster here in Oregon. So definitely healthcare members want to be at the table and be part of the solution. So we hope you lean on us, and we'll ask you to do that, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
So I've had an interesting conversation around prescriptions all session, it seems like, as we've looked at several bills around different prescriptions, and I'm sort of trying to be a flag waiver for a problem with the Affordable Care Act that's coming in 2018, where generous health care plans are going to have a tax on them. And I'm still waiting on a piece of legislation to be drafted to deal with that. And one of the things that strikes me about this conversation, particularly around the resilient side, is, you know, if you're in day 82 of your 90-day prescription, mm-hmm. you're in the same boat as if you are day 15 right. of a third. I mean, right. And the real interest piece for me around, as we're talking about, like, resiliency and data management is, you know, if I live in Tillamook and my pharmacy goes down and I've got, you know, John's Pharmacy, small local pharmacy, and that's where my prescription lives and my doctor's done or whatever. The bigger concern to me is not how many pills does somebody have, but can I access that prescription in Idaho, or, you know, because I've gone to go live with family. Well, no, you can't necessarily if all your medical records are gone and you don't have your bottle or, you know. I mean, the question becomes is how do you get somebody kind of emergently a prescription, and that's a really different conversation than how many pills does somebody have, and I, that's the conversation. I mean, I'll support the bill as it's written, but I that's the conversation I'd like us to have on the resilient side. Is if my doctor's down and my little local pharmacy's gone, and it's not like a CVS or something where they've maybe backed that up and have good data, I'm sort of out of luck in terms of knowing what I take, and if I don't have how many milligrams of whatever I take memorized, that's the real problem. And I don't know how we solve that, but that's what I'd like us, I think, to be looking at, because we do have, I think, a pharmacy database for certain substances on the controlled side. The legislature did that some years ago. Before I got here, because of the sort of doctor shopping and the you know, wanting to get prescriptions for Oxy or whatever. But if you're just on, you know, some statin or a birth control pill or something, that data doesn't exist outside of your local doctor and your pharmacy's records. And if your pharmacy's not a big dog, then those records are gone. And how do we get somebody something the next day, particularly if it's like, you know, a Coumadin for heart medicine or something, it's something that's really necessary. The number of pills in the bottle at that point is sort of irrelevant if all that goes away and you're just leaving. If your house is under rubble, you're probably not digging for your prescription.
Representative,
that's a very good point. But what my concern is if you're like myself, I have to take Lantus. I have to take Novolog. Boy, if I don't have those, and I'm at the 28th day, and something bad happens, I have a real problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a real problem. It's going to cost me my life. But that's my concern on this issue. That's why I think that at least if you had the opportunity to have that prescription for a 90-day period, then of course, even if it's a name brand or if it's generic, and some of the stuff you take is not always generic, what kind of an effect is that going to have on people? That's the concern I think we need to do. As for the
If you're on day 82.
Pardon?
If you're on day 82 of a 90, you're in the same boat.
Well, maybe, maybe not.
You know, potentially. I mean, if you're almost to the end of any prescription, whether it's 30 days, 90 days, 100, you know, 365 days, you're right at the that end. It's sort of irrelevant how much is dispensed, because if it's gone and you're, it's really how do you get it refilled after the.
Well, I look at it like it's 1 in 90 and 1 in 30, Representative.
<I'm just laughs>
I like the 1 in 90 odds better.
I don't disagree.
So I think that it does point out we could have a conversation, the broader conversation about what happens in emergency and some of those issues. I think that would be important to have. It's not just this issue; it's others that you have brought up.
I can't, say I get out of the coast. I'm lucky enough to get out of the coast. And I need like a Coumadin type of prescription. I can't show up at Safeway in West Lynn and say, hey, I used to take this before my house fell into the ocean, and can you give me a prescription? No pharmacy in Oregon has the blanket authority to just, I can just walk up to the counter and get something. So we that's the real issue I think we need to be talking about, and I have yet to hear that in any conversation before today, other than some ones I've had, privately with people. But that's the real issue to me is, you can't get to your doctor record. You can't get to the pharmacy. You could maybe have Representative Esquivel 28th day or 84th day, is gone, and you're down to the last few days. If you don't have the container, if you don't have a record of it, you can't just go somewhere else and say, other than show up at the emergency room, which is not a delivery of, care. And even then, I don't remember exactly which one I took. And Lord forbid you're, somebody who is sort of coming to the twilight years and has a pharmacy on their counter to remember everything you've taken and every dose. That's the real problem to me.
And I'm just suggesting, I think maybe even before we get out of this session, we can have an informational conversation about that and bring in some people. I think we should. I think that's again what we're here for, to talk about under those emergency circumstances. So hopefully we can do that before. That may lead to other conversations, but I think that's a very valid conversation given what our mission is here.
And that conversation was held several years ago when we in OSPAC, and as we worked toward the Oregon Resilience Plan. And
that's where the 90-day thing came from.
That's where it came from.
Okay. Anything else?
By the way, I don't know what I take, but I have it on camera here. I do.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, the emergency.
They
like it.
That's right.
Anything else? Thank you, Elise.
Thank you.
Anybody else who wishes to offer? Where are we at? On Senate Bill 93. Not off. Close the public hearing. Again, Mr. Judge, thank you so very much for participating in this conversation. That was very helpful. Okay, so I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 89. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 89 permits counties and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to appoint volunteers to provide support services and assistance to those that ODVA serves, describes duties and the provisions for oversight, and requires background check and protection of client confidentiality, permits the reimbursement for expenses of other incidentals, and permits ODVA to provide the training. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you very much.
93.
I have nobody on the sign-up sheet. Is there anybody here who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 89? Director Smith, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I had not prepared testimony, but there is a lot of support behind this bill coming over from the Senate side. As we all know, there is a sea of goodwill across partner organizations and other community partners, but there is also a sea of goodwill of individuals looking to better serve veterans and our military families. And this bill puts a little bit of structure around how a county veteran service office or the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs would structure and tap into that volunteer ethos. We've seen it work well through the foster care and the court system in terms of the court-appointed special advocates and the volunteer ethos that helps shepherd foster care kids through the court system. We've seen it on the long-term care ombudsman office in terms of how do you, not from a DHS and government FTE perspective, but how do you get out to skilled nursing facilities and resolve complaints at the lowest level with 200-odd volunteers across Oregon serving aging Oregonians. There's a similar model that we could create in terms of that Vet Corps model of how do you tap into that sea of goodwill, and Senate Bill 89 would be the first step. No large fiscal associated. This is a model that has worked well in Wasco County, tapping into volunteers there to better serve veterans. We will begin to, out of Hyde, try to see how this works in both rural and urban Oregon, and then begin to see if there is traction, how do we begin to invest in this further. Volunteers are highly leveraged, but they're not free. You want to make sure they are trained and supported, but they are huge leverage for our work for our veterans. I'm happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Representative Evans, do you have a question or a comment?
Just about the dash A2s. I'm sure. Trying to fit how that fits.
Go ahead.
How do the dash 2s fit?
Excuse me, Representative Huffman, yes. He can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Leave it up to Rep. Evans to bring something up that we're... It's a recognition component of volunteers, and it's still in the works.
It's still in the works.
Okay. Sounds good. You got a task force on that. Okay.
It may. It's just a work group, sir. We may just have... I have an email into Senator Canope even as we speak to check. It may be recognizing one individual. And the history on this is when Tom Mann was with the department, he probably largely because of one personality had a real aversion to the volunteer effort that was going on in Wasco County.
Yes.
And as things evolved and Tom worked more closely with other people in Wasco County, he came to really appreciate what had been modeled there. And I don't know that Wasco County was the only one that had successfully done this volunteer effort, but Tom specifically mentioned that he would like to replicate what Wasco County was doing around the state. And so one individual that was very, very instrumental in organizing the volunteer effort there to the thousands of hours a year of volunteer efforts for veterans, that's what the amendment hopes to do.
Okay, thank you.
So there's more work on this in that.
I understand.
You, thank you for asking the question. Anything else for Director Smith?
Thank you
very much. Anybody else who wishes to offer testimony on Senate Bill 89? I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 89. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 775. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 775, Alpha, makes pre-disaster measures taken to improve resilience inadmissible as evidence of negligence, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Okay. I'm sure we have a few people here to testify. Why don't you go ahead and come up? I don't have the cheat yet, but I know you're one to provide testimony, so sure. Thank you. Oh, there he is. Okay, thank you both.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, here representing Portland General Electric. Senate Bill 775 is a relatively straightforward piece of legislation. Comes out of some of the resilience planning that the state's been doing and is one of the OSPAC recommendations, and the Public Utilities Commission has encouraged utilities to support this legislation this session, and so we are doing so. It's pretty simple in its action. The status quo for disaster planning for utilities that have pretty significant infrastructure throughout the state is that if you, as a utility, are going out and doing an inventory of vulnerabilities on your system, things that could be damaged, that could have potentially pretty negative impacts on communities if a large event were to occur, that if you are going out, you're doing the planning, you're figuring out what the list is of things that you need to fix, hardening of systems, replacing equipment, et cetera, and a disaster occurs and you have yet to complete the work of going through that inventory and fixing all of those issues that you've identified, you could be potentially at risk of being considered negligent in that you've identified risks and not yet dealt with those risks. For regulated utilities in particular, what we think is a better system is we identify those risks. We go to our regulators to make sure we've got, within our rate cases, we've got the funding, and we put together a plan to go fix those problems on our system. That as long as we've built that list and we're working towards fixing those issues, that we couldn't be considered liable for not having gotten to the end of the list, and that the creation of the list in and of itself is not a liability. In the current, in the status quo, there's somewhat of a disincentive for a utility going out and identifying those risks. We think this is a fairly straightforward issue in terms of changing some of the incentives and creating a structure such that we're not at risk for identifying things that we know need to be fixed on our system. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bruce Anderson with Northwest Natural, and we also are in support of the bill. And the point I would just ditto what Mr. Seaman stated, but also just to point out that the bill is, you know, broader than just utilities. It is designed to address the concern that was expressed in that OSPAC process, but to encourage businesses, schools, public agencies, and others to move forward in identifying and addressing items that may be vulnerable to earthquakes or whatever. Thank you.
Sure. Any questions, Representative Evans?
I may have a question. Is there any other speakers after this?
Or? No.
Okay. I have a question for a potential language adjustment, which I believe is in line with what you guys are talking about. Looking at this, absolutely think that this is the right path because we have to start somewhere. We have to get a list of what needs to be fixed. What I'd like maybe to look at or consider, or even perhaps just through legislative discussion, is making sure that if there are critical things that are identified in the assessment, that there's some rational, responsible timeline. And what I mean by that is that the good actors actually get the plan done in time. Perhaps maybe not so great actors don't get a blanket immunity for something they never intend on fixing. That's my question. So perhaps, you know, some designation of critical or things that need to be fixed in the next little bit or will be, or maybe a timeline of when that list has to be reviewed. Some kind of, again, not hammer, but emphasis to make sure that when agencies are doing this, they know they actually have to get around to getting that list punched out at some point. Does that make sense?
I think so. Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Evans, I think I'd just go back to something that Varner had stated earlier, just in terms of you know, working with our regulators and so forth on that. When it comes to natural gas, our lines are regulated by the federal government.
Right.
So we do have a pipeline integrity management system in place. You know, those are things as we go through the system we're looking at.
Okay. I want to make sure you guys get recognition for what you're trying to do good and make sure that there's no unanticipated consequence. That's all.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in response, Rep. Evans, I would recommend that they take out an ad and talk about the good work they're doing. My concern is if there's any language change, and understanding how litigation works, it might open a door.
But it doesn't need to be. If we all have the same understanding, that's fine. I just...
And in, there aren't any bad actors in Oregon, right? Certainly not the two before.
Not the two in front of us.
Present company.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else who wishes to offer testimony on Senate Bill 775?
775.
Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 775A. I'm going to do this to have Smith come up and then we'll get here.
Okay.
So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 87 and ask Director Smith to come up for just a minute so we can have a conversation about our next steps. Because as I said, we're not going to move it today, but we heard a lot of discussion in our last meeting, which was very helpful. And so And Director Smith didn't get a chance to testify, and so I just wanted to get maybe some of your perspective on what we heard and what the next steps.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I want to thank the committee for the discussion this week on Senate Bill 87. It is not just a conversation about preference and employment. This is about how we better harness the energy, the passion, and the abilities of our veterans when they return home from the battlefield. It's about giving them a continuing mission that is essential for their success in reintegrating home. And this is a conversation that starts from a great place of strength. This is the 70th anniversary year of the end of World War II, 1945 to 2015 today. And from the great, and we've had four generations of veterans across five major wars since. And when the greatest generation returned, not only did they fight and defend our freedom all over the globe, but they returned home and helped build the nation that we have today. And every subsequent generation of veterans has done the same, and it continues. The Oregon National Guard, the 41st Infantry Brigade, got their moniker, the Jungle Leers, for their fight in the South or in the Pacific during World War II. And now, just returning home, they have made up about 10% of the forces in Afghanistan just over the last year. And there is no question, from the greatest generation to this most recent generation, our veterans have the leadership, the teamwork, the mission focus, the integrity that all employers, whether public and private, are looking for. But at the same time, it can be a challenge to translate those same military education skills and experience for civilian employers. When I returned home from three tours in Iraq, I personally had a challenge explaining what I had gained in skills, experience, and education in the military and applying that to civilian employers. And no, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is not just because I am a Marine, a proud member of USMC, Uncle Sam's, Uncle Sam's misguided children. I think the challenge is related to the simple fact that today, less than 1% serve in uniform, so there is a growing disconnect and a gap in understanding between our civilian population and our military in terms of what our veterans and military families experience in challenges and also what are those strengths that they bring home with them. So veterans preference is one way that public employers recognize the service of our veterans and military families. The public employers in Oregon have long given employment preference to veterans, but over time, as hiring practices have changed, we've amended the statutes in ways that we now find aren't as helpful to veterans as they could be. And for that current picture of the current state of veterans preference, I encourage you to read on that is posted to OLIS, the Legislative Council's review of how the statutes and the rules are playing out in practice. And it's very helpful to see that with some of the lack of definitions and clarity that we have muddied the waters, not for a lack of strong intent on hiring veterans from this body and public employers. The scoring, that 5 and 10 that everyone immediately thinks of in terms of veterans' preference, that process is long established, well understood, and easy to apply. The way that preference applies to public employers through the hiring process when we are into that interview scenario has been more challenging. It's currently an undefined and amorphous preference that leaves discretion to the individual public employer and does not serve veterans as well as it could. So Senate Bill 87 is an effort to clearly define and implement veterans' preference. The hard thinking has been done by a diverse work group on the meat of the legislative language. But when we further look through the veterans' lens, and with your help, the bill can be significantly improved. I'm thankful for Representative Evans, Art and the trial lawyers, and most importantly, our veterans community for their work to strengthen the bill through the Dash 6 amendments. With the amendments, we can ensure that there are clear definitions for preference, both in that scoring and in the interview processes, and answer the critical question of when is it applied in the process. We can ensure that there's no discretion or escape clause that lets agency by agency define what they think preference is. It makes a uniform application across all public employers. The amendments would ensure that preference, that it is a more meaningful preference for veterans. When we have gone in 2011 and tried to encourage more interviews, in practice now we have a breadth of interviews being offered to minimum for veterans that meet the minimum qualifications. Senate Bill 87 with the amendments would ensure not on the minimum qualification side, but that your top five veteran candidates would be ensured an interview on every open job offered by a public employer. and make sure that there is no opportunity, whether it is confusion or simply gamesmanship, on how veterans' preference is applied. And the amendments would have a shared onus and burden for both the veteran to submit what their transferable skills are, but also that the public employer give weight to those same transferable skills. And lastly, it would still allow, when preference is misapplied, for that full review, both by BOLI or any legal review. So Senate Bill 87 with the Dash 6 amendments, we can say very clearly, will deepen veterans' preference, hold public employers accountable, and ensure veterans have a right to BOLI and legal review, but that as a matter of routine, veterans will not need a regulator or a lawyer to know if they simply receive the preference that they have earned through their service. This is one step in our effort to make sure we harness that energy of our veterans coming back. A number of different efforts we've heard through this committee, but around this employment and economic opportunity, beyond this bill, we need to continue to look at ways to invest in coaching and guiding veterans as they transition. It is a transition from the military to that civilian side and workforce, and also encourage all employers, public and private, to better understand what are those transferable strengths. And happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Director Smith? Thank you very much for taking the time to provide that. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 87. Now we have a few we're going to try to move. So I'll open the work session. There's yours over there. Oh, there we go. Senate Bill 251. Mr. Administrator, you remind us what this is about?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 251, we heard first on 423, clarifies the authority of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to act without bond as a fiduciary for veterans' benefits and to receive the payee and Social Security, supplemental Social Security income benefits on behalf of the qualifying veterans and their dependents, declares an emergency effective on passage. Some of the things the committee discussed were ODVA's role as conservator versus a representative payee. No revenue, no fiscal impact.
Okay.
Chair Lively, I move Senate Bill 251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Comments? If not, please call the roll.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative
Parrish?
Aye. Representative
Fluso?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a... somebody the ones who carried this on as well? Representative Esquivel, thank you very much. And you notice the others were leaving quick enough to
get the vote and they all leave.
You notice that?
No.
So,
do we have a vice chair?
So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 251. And I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 252.
I think it's work session.
Hmm? Work session. Oh, sorry, work session. It's a good thing somebody's here to tell me what I'm supposed to be doing. I just do it. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senate Bill 252A exempts Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs from foreclosure mediation process required of traditional lenders on home loans that ODVA administers. The committee met on 423, and again today, there's no fiscal, no revenue impact.
Okay. Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 252A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 252A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Not, please call the roll.
Vice Chair Boone?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative
Luso?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a carrier for this measure? A volunteer carrier. Representative Huffman, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, as long as somebody on the back row agrees to give me some talk points on the floor.
Oh.
I see a volunteer.
You see a volunteer. Okay, good job. Okay, so I'm going to open a work session. Did I get that right this time?
Yes, sir.
On SCR 8. Mr.
Chairman, committee members, SCR 8 memorializes Oregon State Senator Blaine Whipple. The committee saw this on May 5th. Again, there is no revenue, no fiscal impact, but with all the measures we're working out today, you have all the paperwork.
All the paperwork. Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move SCR 8A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves SCR 8A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? comments? Not, please call the roll.
Vice Chair Boone?
Excused.
Vice Chair
Esquivel? Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye. Motion passes. Carrier for this measure. Anybody? Nobody? I'll carry it.
Okay.
And we're going to open a work session for SJM 11. Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, SJM 11 urges Congress to improve the delivery of care to rural veterans. The committee met on May 21st. No fiscal, no revenue.
Okay.
Chair Lively, I move SJM 11 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves SJM 11 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Vice Chair
Boone? Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye. Motion carries. Carrier for that. Representative Evans?
Yes, sir. Ed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Now open a work session on Senate Bill 253A.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senate Bill 253A makes certain veterans and service members' personal identifiable information exempt from disclosure pursuant to public records request when obtained and kept by Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs in the performance of its functions. The committee met on April 30th. There's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact, which again you have before you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 253A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 253A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Vice Chair Boone?
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Lever?
Aye. Motion passes. The carrier for this one.
For what?
Representative Parrish,
would you like to carry this
one? Which one? Sorry,
we're talking. SB 253A.
Yes. We
okay,
can do that.
Thank you for that.
I was just saying, in the SCR 8A, the former senator came from the Beaverton area. Maybe we should task a carrier from his previous
district. That's
probably district,
not a we can ask about
anyway,
that.
Thinking about that.
Thank you.
I was thinking about Rip Greenlake might enjoy carrying. Encouraging people to not.
Oh, I know that. I thought about that one too, Representative Huffman, but I but I think Evans will do a better job. Okay, so we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 494.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senate Bill 494 permits the Oregon Department of Transportation to renew or replace out-of-state service members' driver's license without the photograph. We met on April 30th. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 494 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 494 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Vice Chair Boone?
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative
Peluso? Aye.
Chair Lerner?
Aye. Motion carries.
Carry that for
that
Senator Bates.
Thank you. Any other business to come before our committee?
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.